Hey, podcasters, it's Independence Eve, and we've got a couple of things special for Independence Day. We have the explanation and the reading of the Declaration of Independence and the Gettysburg Address, which are both here. I mean, not the Declaration, but the engraving, the 1826 engraving of the first draft of the Constitution or Declaration of Independence is here. And the Gettysburg Address is here at our Mercury Studios for this weekend only, part of our pop-up museum. Get your tickets at mercuryone.org. But we have Abby Johnson on today's show. We talk about how to say Antifa or Antifa. It's very important because we had Andy Ngo on with us. He talks about the Antifa rally and his injury, and he does not sound well. Also, Charlie Kirk and what's happening with the Trump campaign and what's happening on college campuses, all on today's podcast.
You're listening to the best of the Glenn Beck program.
We have been done such a great disservice by our educational system because it does not teach the principles of our country. In fact, it maligns them and undermines them every step of the way. It teaches our children, and it taught many of us, things that just are not true, or they admitted. There is the sin of omission. For my whole life, I've wondered, how could Thomas Jefferson, and this is one of the reasons why he's called the American Sphinx, how could Thomas Jefferson write the words that we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, and then have slaves? Well, part of that is understandable by saying, well, in his day, not everybody was considered equal or even men, and it got worse after Origin of the Species. Origin of the Species, the subtitle is something along the lines, I wish I would have written it down so I had it here, something along the lines of or Origin of the Species or Survival of the Superior Races. Oh, okay. Thank you. Now science was brought into it. No, these are superior races. The Africans just aren't fully baked, I guess. They haven't evolved. That's why you have the image of the African as a monkey. Because Origin of the Species basically said that. So once you get the science of the modern world, and the progressives that know oh so much about the modern world, you start to mix science with the desires of some evil men, and this whole thing is torn apart. But our founders, I should say 10 out of the 13 colonies, 10 out of the 13 colonies, they knew it. They wanted to abolish slavery. Thomas Jefferson knew it. But before they even uttered a word about what they were going to write down on this declaration to send to the king, John Hancock came up and said, you know, the king is going to separate us. He's going to try. He's got power. He has money. He has agents everywhere. He will find the things that we disagree on, and he will separate us. And if we are not locked in arms, if we aren't agreed on every single principle, he will separate us. And he will use those people. He will peel them away one by one. He'll turn us against each other. And then we're done. So before we even begin to write, let us vote. Should everything in this document be unanimous? Everybody said yes. They all knew. We know today, if you're not in lockstep on everything, they're going to peel you apart. But in the first draft, in the usurpation section, where they're talking about the crimes of the king, a section that nobody reads, In the first draft, there was something that Thomas Jefferson himself wrote. And if you look at his draft, even his writing changes. He defines men. Yes, Africans, slaves, are men. I want you to hear the Declaration of Independence. I want you to listen to it, including the usurpations. And I want to add in the one thing that three colonies, North and South Carolina and Georgia, voted no on. But I want you to hear the intent of our founders, including Thomas Jefferson, and the 10 other states that voted yes. You won't have a hard time picking it out. Most of the things are one or two lines that the king has done. This is a full paragraph. Again, that's why at the very beginning of the Declaration of Independence, it says in Congress, July 4th, 1776, the unanimous declaration of the 13 United States. When, in the course of human events, it becomes necessary for one people to dissolve the political bands which have connected them with one another, and to assume among the powers of the earth the separate and equal stations to which the laws of nature and of nature's God entitle them. A decent respect to the opinions of mankind requires that they should declare the causes which impel them to the separation. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, and that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, that to secure these rights, governments are instituted among men, deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed, that when any form of government becomes destructive of these ends, it is the right of the people to alter or abolish it, and to institute a new government, laying its foundation on such principles and organizing its powers in such form as to them shall seem most likely to affect their safety and happiness. Prudence, indeed, would dictate that governments long established should not be changed for light and transient causes. And accordingly, all experience has shown that mankind are more disposed to suffer while evils are sufferable than to right themselves by abolishing the forms to which they are accustomed. But when a long train of abuses and usurpations, pursuing invariable the same object, evinces a design to reduce them under absolute despotism, it is their right, it is their duty, to throw off such government and provide new guards for their future security. Such has been the patient sufferance of these colonies, and such is now the necessity which constrains them to alter their former systems of government. The history of the present King of Great Britain is a history of repeated injuries and usurpations, all having a direct object, the establishment of an absolute tyranny over these states. And to prove this, let facts be submitted to a candid world. This king has refused to assent to laws, the most wholesome and necessary for the public good. He has forbidden his governors to pass laws of immediate and pressing importance unless suspended in their operation till his assent should be obtained, and when so suspended, he has utterly neglected to attend them. He has refused to pass other laws for the accommodation of large districts of people, unless those people would relinquish the right of representation in the legislature, a right inestimable to them and formidable to tyrants only. He has called together legislative bodies at places unusual, uncomfortable, and distant for the sole purpose of fatiguing them into compliance with his measures. He has dissolved representative houses repeatedly for opposing with manly firmness his invasions on the rights of the people. He's refused for a long time after such disillusions to cause others to be elected, whereby the legislative powers, incapable of annihilation, have returned to the people at large for their exercise, the state remaining in the meantime exposed to all the dangers of invasion from without and convulsions within. He has endeavored to prevent the population of these states for that purpose, obstructing the laws for naturalization of foreigners, refusing to pass others to encourage their migrations thither, and raising the conditions of new appropriation of lands. He's affected to render the military independent of and superior to the civil power. He's combined with others to subject us to a jurisdiction foreign to our Constitution and unacknowledged by our laws, giving his assent to their acts of pretended legislation, for quartering large bodies of armed troops among us, for protecting them by mock trial from a punishment of any murders which they should commit on the inhabitants of these states, for cutting off all of our trade with parts of the world, for imposing taxes on us without consent, for depriving us, in many cases, of the benefit of trial by jury, for transporting us beyond seas to be tried for pretended offenses, for abolishing the free system of English laws in a neighboring province, establishing therein an arbitrary government, and enlarging its boundaries so as to render it at once an example and fit instrument for inducing the same absolute rule into these colonies, for taking away our charters, abolishing our most valuable laws, and altering fundamentally the forms of government. He has plundered our seas, he has ravaged our coasts, he has burnt our towns, and he has destroyed the lives of our people. He is at this time transporting large armies of foreign mercenaries to complete the works of death, desolation, and tyranny already begun, with the circumstances of cruelty unworthy the head of a civilized nation. He has incited treasonable insurrections in our fellow subjects, with the allurements of forfeiture and confiscation of our property. He has waged cruel war against human nature itself, violating its most sacred rights of life and liberty in the persons of a distant people who never offended him, captivating and carrying them into slavery in another hemisphere, or to incur miserable death in their transportation thither. This warfare, the opprobrium of infidel powers, is the warfare of a Christian king of Great Britain, determined to keep an open market where men should be bought and sold. He has prostituted his negative for suppressing every legislative attempt to prohibit or restrain this commerce. And that this assemblage of horrors might want no fact of distinguished dye, he is now exciting those very people to rise in arms among us and to purchase that liberty of which he has deprived them by murdering the people upon whom he has also obtruded them, thus paying off former crimes committed against the liberties of one people with crimes in which he urges them to commit against the lives of another. In every stage of these oppressions, we have petitioned for redress in most humble terms, and our repeated petitions have been answered only by repeated injury. A prince whose character is thus marked by every act which may define a tyrant is unfit to be the ruler of a man to be free. Future ages will scarcely believe the hardiness of one man. We have not been wanting in our attentions to our British brethren. We have warned them from time to time of the attempts by their legislature to extend an unwarrantable jurisdiction over us. We have reminded them of the circumstances of our immigration and settlement here. We've appealed to their native justice and magnanimity. We have conjured them by the ties of our common kindred to disavow these usurpations, which they would inevitably interrupt our connections and correspondence. But they, too, have been deaf to the voice of justice. We must, therefore, acquiesce in the necessity which denounces our separation and hold them, as we hold the rest of mankind, enemies in war, in peace, friends. We, therefore, the representatives of the United States of America in General Congress assembled, appealing to the Supreme Judge of the world for the rectitude of our intentions, do in the name and by the authority of the good people of these colonies, solemnly publish and declare that these United Colonies and of right ought to be free and independent states, and that they are absolved from all allegiance to the British Crown, and that all political connection between them and the state of Great Britain is and ought to be totally dissolved, and that as free and independent states, they have the full power to levy war, conclude peace, contract alliances, establish Congress, and do all other acts and things which independent states may right to do. And for support of this declaration, with a firm reliance on the protection of divine providence, we mutually pledge to each other our lives, our fortunes, and our sacred honor. Hi, it's Glenn. If you're a subscriber to the podcast, can you do us a favor and rate us on iTunes? If you're not a subscriber, become one today and listen on your own time. You can subscribe on iTunes. Thanks. Four score and 7 years ago, our fathers brought forth on this continent a new nation, conceived in liberty and dedicated to the proposition that all men are created equal. Now, we are engaged in a great civil war, testing whether that nation, or any nation so conceived and so dedicated, can long endure. We are met on a great battlefield of that war. We have come to dedicate a portion of that field as a final resting place for those who here gave their lives that that nation might live. It's altogether fitting and proper that we should do this, but in a larger sense, we cannot dedicate. We cannot consecrate, we cannot hallow this ground. The brave men, living and dead, who struggled here, they have consecrated it far above our poor power to add or detract. The world will little note nor long remember what we say here, but it can never forget what they did here. It is for us, the living, rather, to be dedicated. To be dedicated here to the unfinished work which those who fought here have thus far so nobly advanced. It is rather for us here to be dedicated to the great task remaining before us, that from these honored dead we take increased devotion to that cause for which they gave their last full measure of devotion. That we here highly resolve that these dead shall not have died in vain, that this nation, under God, shall have a new birth of freedom, and the government of the people, by the people, and for the people, shall not perish from the earth.
The best of the Glenn Beck program. You're listening to the best of the Glenn Beck program.
Abby Johnson is with us. She is the CEO and founder of And Then There Were None. She's also the author of the book Unplanned, which was just a hit movie in America. If you haven't seen it, I'm sure it's... Is it going to be on... Let me ask Abby. Are they going to put it on Amazon and Netflix?
Yes, it will be out Yeah, it'll be out. I'm not sure which platforms they'll hold it yet, but it'll be streaming and out on DVD August 13th.
That's great. That's great. Abby, how have you been? I know this year has been really stressful with the movie and everything else. First, how are you?
Yeah, I'm good. I had a baby a month ago.
Oh, congratulations. So, boy or girl or Buick? Because we all know that it's not life in there always.
Exactly.
Yeah.
A little boy named Fulton, and he's just precious. He was our eighth baby, so, you know, life is busy around here. It's great.
I'm sorry. I think the phone cut out. You said it was your eighth baby?
Eighth baby. Well, you know, we're just trying to repopulate.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a lot of children. It's a lot of children. But I have to tell you, I was a guy in my 20s that I didn't want any children. Now I have four, and I wish I had 10. There is nothing better. I mean, you'll lose all of your hair and your eyebrows and everything, but
sure.
There's nothing better.
And money.
Yeah, I know. Okay, so Abby, I want to talk to you about something that I think is controversial that I don't think should be, and I commend you for doing this. You started Bottles to the Border. Tell me about this.
Yeah, so I've been wanting to send items down to the border. It's not easy to do something like that. You think it would be, but the detention centers won't take items. And so trying to find places that will take items where people can access them who really need them can be a little difficult. And so I called a friend of mine, Destiny De La Rosa, and we just started talking about it, and we said, you know, we really need a combined effort from the pro-life movement. You know, who can do this, who can gather supplies. And I said, I'm gonna put out a registry. So we contacted four different centers that are working with immigrants. And so these would be places where the immigrants would go after they've left the detention centers. And they go there with nothing. I mean, they don't even have shoelaces. Shoelaces are taken in the detention center. Kids don't have toys. I mean, there's just nothing. And so a lot of moms, you know, who need baby supplies, who need nursing items, just, I mean, basic things that we take for granted, they don't have. And so we thought, you know, this really isn't a political issue. This is sort of just a human rights issue. We need to get down there and figure out how to help people. And so we started talking to different pro-life groups, and surprisingly, people were not, we weren't surprised that they wanted to get involved. We were surprised that they were actually willing to put their name on it, because like you said, this becomes controversial when it's just about helping people.
When I did this, I don't know, 4 or 5 years ago, went down to the border under Obama, and I was telling people then, because the border guards were telling me, these people who are being demonized, these border guards were saying, please, you've got to get people to wake up, and what's happening, they're putting children in cages and breaking up the families. I called every single reporter that I knew that was on the left and said, don't use my name if you don't want to, nothing, just please check this out. Here are names that you can call in the border guard that need this exposed. Nobody was interested on the left, and unfortunately on the right for a while, until people started getting a handle on it. People thought I was saying that we have to, you know, welcome these people across the border. No. No, I just want to take care of people. When you were hungry, I fed you. When you were in prison, I visited you. When you didn't have clothes, I clothed you. That's what we're supposed to do. And then let the machinery of the government take care of sending these people back.
Exactly. And you know, we hear all the time pro-lifers saying, we don't want government interference. We need the churches to step up. Okay, well, let's step up, right? Like, let's be the church. Let's help these people who are in these desperate situations. I don't care why they're here. I'm not really interested in that. I just want to help them while they are here right now, while they are in need. And we talked to some of these respite centers. They are receiving 500 to 800 people a day.
Mm-hmm.
That's a number that most, I mean, can you imagine like 500 to 800 people? You're having to clothe them, take care of them, house them, help get them medical care. So it's really easy for conservatives to say, you know, well, we are taking care of them. It's such an overwhelming number that a lot of people are falling through the cracks. And so how
and a lot of towns, a lot of towns yeah. are falling through the cracks. A lot of churches are collapsing because they yeah. cannot do it. It is the church's responsibility. When I say church, I don't mean with a capital C. I mean small c, us, all of us. It is our gospel requirement to clothe the needy, to feed the hungry. And they are here, and we are letting our capital C churches collapse all along the border and our towns getting ready to collapse because there's no money to do it.
Right. So we gathered all this stuff. So we did an Amazon registry. We had a drop point for one of our, we do registries a lot for single moms, moms that choose life who are in desperate need of resources. So we're sort of like a well-oiled machine for large baby registries.
Mm-hmm.
And so this was that times 100. So we had a drop point. One of our staff members, Brenda, there were none. Everything was being shipped to her. Everything was organized. We had a team of people go to her house, get everything organized. And then we got the coolest offer. So a man that goes to her church, that he owns an 18-wheeler trucking company. Mm-hmm. And he said, I will donate a truck, the time, and a driver if you can fill it up and get supplies down to the border. So we have an 18-wheeler that we are filling up with supplies and taking down there to the border. And the most needed items are, I think, just basic things, diapers and protein boosting milk for kids, formula, shoelaces. Every single person that comes, 500 to 800 pairs of shoelaces are needed per day because they're taken in detainment.
Day.
They need, the kids come in. Oh, they told us 500 to 800 people come in per day. About half of those are children. I mean, come on, people, wake up. These are kids. It doesn't matter why their parents are here. It doesn't matter their immigration status. These are children.
And some of these children have been kidnapped and taken and are destined for really horrible things. We
Absolutely.
Have to care for them.
Yes. And so we're just really excited. So we're taking an 18-wheeler down to the border. We have 4 different centers that we're working with. 2 of them can take supplies, 2 of them cannot because they just don't have the facilities. So we have raised almost $40,000 to divide between these centers to help them take in the immigrants that are coming. And it's just been really beautiful to see the pro-life movement come together and to work on this cause together and to show people that it's not just about abortion. I mean, this is about human rights, period.
So,
whether it's the child in the womb, whether it's the immigrant at the border, we have to care about both equally.
So tell me, and this is so good because I'm tired of people saying, oh, well, if Christians really believed in pro-life, what about all the babies that are born that are unwanted? Well, here, right here, right here. We'll help, and we'll do it. Where can you give?
Yeah, so the best thing to do is I'm going to be making a fresh post today on my Facebook page. If you type in Abby Johnson, it's the first one that'll pop up. I'm also going to be making a fresh Twitter post today and a post on Instagram, Abby Johnson on both of those. And people can go, they can donate monetary gifts if they would like to do that.
Are you, do you have or something I can just put my credit card in and give?
Yep.
Okay.
Yep. Super easy. And then we also have the Amazon registry back open. Now that we have the 18-wheeler, we've added additional supplies because we want to fill that sucker up.
I mean, so how do we do that on Amazon?
You have an 18-wheeler donated to go down with supplies. So we want to fill it up and take it down there.
Hopefully we'll have more than need for more 18-wheelers. How do I get to the Amazon page?
Yeah, so I'll have all of that on my Facebook page. I'll have a link to the Amazon registry. I'll have a link to how people can make donations. All very easy.
Okay.
And I'll make a fresh post today so that everybody can see it. I'll make it this morning.
Okay, please do. You can follow her at Twitter at Abby Johnson. You can also find her Facebook page, Abby Johnson, and her website is abbyjohnson.org, Bottles to the Border. I think this is courageous and really great, Abby. And let me know how we can help, because I would like to also be of assistance to you. I think what
you're... Thank you. And we're going to be actually there on the 13th, on July 13th.
Okay.
Is the day that we're traveling down. So if people are interested in helping us unload, I mean, unloading this truck is going to be a feat, getting everything into these centers, getting it organized for them.
Okay, so let's talk Monday, maybe after the holiday, and we'll see if we can get some people to help you.
Yeah, so if you're interested in helping us, if you're going to be down in McAllen, and help us, you know, want to help us unload, they can email me at my website, abbyjohnson.org.
Thank you very much, Abby. I appreciate it.
This is the best of the Glenn Beck program.
Hey, it's Glenn, and if you like what you hear on the program, you should check out Pat Gray Unleashed. His podcast is available wherever you download your favorite podcast. Let's go to Andy Ngo, who I am begging some university to give him an honorary doctorate so he can officially be Dr. Ngo. Welcome, Andy. How are you? Andy,
thank
are you there?
For having me on. I am. Hello.
Yes. How are you feeling, first off?
I've been in a lot of pain and exhausted. I've been particularly concerned that I've been having some difficulty with speaking, but I'm pushing myself to do all the media interviews because I'm hoping that the story is not just one of some person getting beat up in a city, but rather has the potential to move the needle on the national discourse on far less militancy. And I want people to be confronted by the brutality of this Antifa movement.
Have you done any mainstream media? Has CNN reached out to you, ABC, NBC, any of these people?
I've been on Tucker Carlson. I've been on other Fox shows. And I was also invited and accepted to do an interview on CNN yesterday morning.
Are you surprised by the response of the press saying that you're not a journalist and it really was just a little bump in the head? It was no big deal.
I wish I could say I was surprised, but I'm not. There's militant Antifa is a very small number of people, but the larger and more concerning should be the focus on the larger concentric circle of what I call nonviolent Antifa. And these are people who are sympathetic to the ideas of this movement, mainly Marxism and violence against the right. And so they work in journalism and progressive media and sometimes mainstream center-left media. And they work to whitewash and sanitize the ideology and tactics of Antifa. And so there's a machine in work that has been in work for years now to mainstream aspects of this militant paramilitary movement. So I shouldn't be surprised that they're coming to try to delegitimize my work and who I am as a justification for the attack.
Portland police officers, I'm quoting the Portland mayor, Portland police officers have the unenviable task of keeping peace. It's a difficult job and hard decisions are made in real time. I saw your video. I watched all of them. And you practically begged the police to help and to wake up to what was happening to you. And then you were beaten and they didn't arrive at all. You had to go back to them. What is your opinion of what the police did or did not do? Were they, do you believe they were on orders not to get involved at all?
I don't blame any rank and file officers because for months now, Antifa has been intimidating, harassing, and assaulting me, and I have many pending open investigations that preceded Saturday's assault. And their responses every time these attacks happen, many within the eyesight of the police, their responses always that they cannot move in to question, detain, or approach the suspects because this could incite the crowd. So this signals to me that this is a problem in the policing tactics of the police. It comes from higher up. So the city has already been on notice about the violent militancy of Antifa since 2016. To remind our listeners who may not be aware, after the results of the election were announced in November, there was violent rioting in the city where $1 million in damage was done in downtown and fires were started on the streets and masked individuals carrying bats and other weapons went around destroying cars, breaking windows. It was complete anarchy and we keep having these bouts of violence.
So what should
a major American city?
What should be done? Andy,
I think the DOJ needs to step in. The Department of Homeland Security, since 2016, has described some of the activities of Antifa as domestic terrorist violence. And so this is a problem that for, I think, the federal authorities to step in because local authorities, particularly in Portland, where the mayor, who also doubles as a police commissioner and is up for re-election in a city that hates police, he has all the incentive in the world to weaken the law enforcement practices and to allow far less militants to run amok on the streets.
This is very reminiscent in many ways of what happened on the streets in southern towns where the mayor and the police chief would allow protesters to be beaten and did nothing about it until the federal government got involved. Andy, we wish you the very best and a speedy recovery. If there's anything that any of us can do besides pray for you, we stand ready to do it. God bless you and thank you so much.
Thanks for bringing attention to the story.
You bet. Andy No. You can follow him at Mr. Andy No, N-G-O, Andy N-G-O, on Twitter.
This is the best of the Glenn Beck program.
Charlie Kirk is joining us now. Charlie Kirk is a truly amazing, amazing individual. He's the founder and president of Turning Point USA. He's the host of the Charlie Kirk Show. You can find him at tpusa.com. And we welcome him to the program today. Charlie, I want to start with, I want to cover, if I can, if I have time, three different things with you. The first one is the 4th of July celebration. The 4th of July celebration, the Democrats are now saying this is a partisan thing. He's taken over the mall celebration, America's celebration, and Donald Trump is doing, you know, just a partisan thing. Well, I would normally say that wasn't true, but I believe if the other party, now their stance is that America is a bad place, and many are even saying that they hate America, don't tell me that it's good, I guess it is a partisan thing. There's half the people that say, no, I don't agree with that. It's a pretty sweet place to be.
No doubt. And they're making it a partisan thing. And thank you so much for having me, Glenn. Always sure. Such a great honor. But where does this idea come from? Where has the horrific anti-American sentiment stemmed from? It's from our universities. This has been 40 and 50 years in the making. And right. 5 or 6 years ago, as I really started to get our work going at Turning Point USA, I started to see measures on college campuses, such as American flags being banned from in dormitory rooms in the University of California system. And I started to see not just left-wing students talk about their radical ideology, but instead just be so outwardly anti-American. And now this has metastasized into the top levels of Democrat leadership. I mean, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez does not just come out of nowhere. She was created and incubated in colleges. She's a prototype of the radical left, and now it's become mainstream. And I sent out a tweet this morning kind of joking around a little bit saying only the Democrats could be upset that there'll be money spent to celebrate America, but they're perfectly fine having billions of dollars in cash flown on a private jet to Iran who wants us dead.
Exactly right. Only
the modern Democrats could come up with that sort of, you know, illogical approach.
Let me talk to you a little bit about Students for Trump. It's just been announced that you have a budget now of $15 million, 150 staffers, and a presence on more than 1,400 college campuses. And you are going to do the largest Get Out the Vote program targeting students on college campuses for a Republican president ever. How are you going to break through to these people who, as you said, it's been metastasized? They're not for only 28% of students are looking at Donald Trump and saying, he's a good guy, I like his policies.
Well, the good thing about being at 28% is you got almost nowhere to go but up. And
right.
the best thing about being surrounded is you can shoot in any direction. But look, I do believe that those polls are a little bit misrepresentative. There are far more students that have a positive perspective of the president than I think those polls will reflect. But make no mistake, the road to the White House goes straight through college campuses. And not to oversimplify 2020, but the Democrats have very specific, I call them policy bribes almost, targeting young people. Student loan forgiveness, almost their entire climate agenda is catering towards younger coastal voters that have no connection to the heartland of our country. Malibu and Manhattan is the extent of their worldview, not Missouri, Michigan, or Montana. And so it's up to us, our effort going into 2020 through our Students for Trump vehicle, to add a little sobriety, add a little realism and truth. And the message is quite simple. Is we're going to say, wait a second, you say you don't trust the government, because a lot of these students say they don't trust the government, then why on earth would you want to make government bigger and more powerful and give more of your money and give more of your freedom to that government? Because a lot of these students say, well, our government is bought and paid for by the corporations and the special interests. I say, all right, that's a reasonable approach. Then why on earth would you want to give that very same government control over your health care and of your decisions? And so, look, it's a uphill battle, to say the least, Glenn, but it's a clash that we're going to embrace, because in order for Donald Trump to get reelected, he needs to exceed expectations on college campuses. And the Democrats right now and the radical left are not expecting any sort of obstacle on college campuses, and we hope to at least make it competitive again, not just allow the left to have a monopoly over the next generation.
So, Charlie, the other thing that has really concerned me is the arrogance of Silicon Valley. We know through studies that are done at Harvard that Google is changing results for their search and stacking things for the Democrats, and it is very effective. We also know that they're conservative, you know, they're deplatforming or just changing their algorithms to make sure that they're not highlighting people. I mean, me, when I search and I watch something of me on YouTube, I can't get them to recommend another video by me. And it's me. I mean, it's like, this is nuts. I know the president is meeting with Google and I believe YouTube next week. The Justice Department is going to be there. What do you foresee happening there?
Yeah, and so there's a social media summit next week at the White House, and I will be there. And to kind of extrapolate that point a little more, Glenn, which is a brilliant one, the Silicon Valley elites, they look at themselves as philosopher kings, as the philosopher king that Plato talked about thousands of years ago. That's who they think they are. They believe they are smarter, they believe they are better, and they believe they deserve more power and no one should ever question them. And some could make the argument that Google is more dangerous currently than the Internal Revenue Service.
Oh, I agree.
The IRS doesn't even use email still. Mm-hmm. You still have to write them a letter to the post office.
Right.
Google could overthrow a government. Google could change public sentiment. 92% of all search results go through Google. And so, look, I applaud the president for having some sort of a forum to at least cross-examine and hopefully challenge Silicon Valley. And I think an important thing to note here, Glenn, is we as free market people and as followers of Adam Smith and Milton Friedman, we should be very cautious and careful to ever call for government regulation. However, when these big tech companies are sometimes using government contracts and taxpayer funding to advance their agenda, that should be discontinued. So, for example, Amazon is on the verge of signing a $10 billion taxpayer-funded contract through Amazon Web Services to house all the Pentagon and cloud data. And that's just that's cronyism. That's not capitalism.
And I would rather see us, I mean, instead of regulation, just threaten their status as a platform.
Yes.
You're a publisher. And they do not, that'll put them out of business because of lawsuits. So, I mean, just that one threat should turn them around.
No doubt. And I think your audience is very aware of this. And I hear this concern amongst the grassroots all across the country that there's almost been a super government created. It's almost as if there's two sources of power now.
Yes.
In America, the government and the information processing distribution. And they're thousands of miles away from each other, but they agree on basically everything.
Yep.
And while most of our movement has been very focused, rightfully so, on the deep state within Washington, there is a deep state built in Silicon Valley.
And it's really not even American. I mean, it doesn't care who is in charge of anything in the future. They will be much more powerful than any government.
And they're on pace to have technology that the government will never be able to catch up to at all.
Yes.
It's almost as if there's a super government being created.
Yes.
And it's an oligopoly. And it's an oligopoly and an oligarchy. And there is no diversity of opinion. There's no diversity of thought. Just last year, you had one of the Google employees who dared send a memo about pushing back against gender stereotypes, something of that nature, which was not a controversial memo when you read it. And he was fired almost instantaneously. Ted Cruz brilliantly cross-examined the head of user experience at Google and asked her how many political contributions went to Hillary Clinton versus Donald Trump. $0 to Donald Trump and over $1.2 million to Hillary Clinton. And so we have to continue to signal the alarm against this, and you've done a great job of it. And we saw what happened to Steven Crowder getting demonetized recently. And they're going to continue to encroach on every single conservative content creator until we take a stand against it. And I think your solution of make them be treated as a publisher, not as a platform, because they are acting as a publisher.
Yeah, they are. They are. Thank you so much, Charlie. I appreciate it. Charlie Kirk from TPUSA. We'll talk to you again, and love to have you on next week after that to get an inside scoop on what exactly happened at that meeting in the White House. All right. Our sponsor this half hour. By the way, we're going to end the show with a reading of the Gettysburg Address. It's an amazing document, and was like 2.5 minutes long. That's it. And the original was thrown away because everybody thought, oh, it's not going to be that important.
The Blaze Radio Network. On demand.